Hi, everyone, and welcome to Climate Proofers, the show all about those on the front lines of adaptation, finance, tech, and policy. I'm Louis Woodall, editor of the Climate Proof newsletter, which you can read at www.climateproof.news. It's all over, folks. COP30 gaveled to a close last Saturday amidst a storm of controversy and plenty of shoulda, woulda, couldas from angry, sleep-deprived delegates. Heading into this summit, there were high hopes for the global adaptation agenda. This was to be a, quote, adaptation COP, where important but all too often overlooked aspects of the Paris Agreement would finally get their time in the spotlight. Looking at the wad of agreed texts coming out of the closing plenary, however, COP30's record on adaptation was mixed at best. On the positive side of the ledger, we saw countries agree to a tripling of adaptation finance and the launch of a slew of initiatives focused on scaling up investment in countries' national adaptation plans, or NAPs. But on the not-so-positive side, negotiators fumbled the foundational plank of multilateral adaptation policy, the Global Goal on Adaptation, or GGA. This COP was supposed to bring agreement on a list of adaptation indicators, drawn up by a technical expert group, that could be used by countries to track their adaptation progress. Instead, in a messy compromise, negotiators cobbled together a batch of 59 indicators that deviated in important ways from the expert group's submissions, leaving some observers to doubt whether they could be implemented at all. To walk us through these adaptation wins and fails, I'm delighted to welcome Ana Melillo Alvarez back to the Climate Proofers podcast. Ana is a policy advisor at E3G, a climate diplomacy think tank specializing in all things adaptation. She offers her unvarnished opinions on the COP30 summit overall, goes into forensic detail on the adaptation agreements coming out of the summit, and gives us a hint as to what might happen next. It's an information-rich, high-calorie conversation perfect for all you COP anoraks out there. If you like the episode, let Ana and me know by messaging louis@climateproof.news and by dropping a rating and review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. For those of you ready to move on from COP mania, never fear, I haven't forgotten about you. Next week, Climate Proofers has an exciting episode on adaptation tech in the pests, invasive species, and biological threats arena with a new startup VC fund. Plus, future episodes will range more widely into private adaptation finance and non-COP-related policy. For now, though, settle in and enjoy our COP30 breakdown with Ana. Hi, Ana. Where are you calling from today, and what do you do?
Hi, yes, I'm calling from Brussels, and I am a policy advisor at a climate diplomacy think tank called E3G, where I provide insights into climate change adaptation diplomacy, particularly in the realm of the UNFCCC, but also the G7 and the G20.
Thank you for being here, Ana. This is the second year in a row that you've come onto the Climate Proofers podcast to provide a wrap-up of what went on at COP. And this summit in Belém was signposted by the Brazilian presidency and ministers as an adaptation COP. There was supposed to be some significant progress made on certain adaptation priorities. And my first question to you then is, how successful would you say the Belém summit and the Brazilian presidency was in elevating adaptation to the same level of importance as mitigation?
I think that the presidency really did try to make this the adaptation COP. I think that all the signals were there throughout the year. I think they particularly put their, you know, diplomatic weight behind the new finance goal for adaptation. The biggest outcome on the entire negotiated package was on adaptation and the Just Transition Work Program. But I do think that Lula's speech at the beginning of COP really threw kind of whole new sets of headlines that I don't think the presidency's team had been expecting. So Lula came out in the World Leader Summit section and said, you know, we really need a roadmap. And my mitigation colleagues had been waiting for something like this for a very long time. And the media picked it up. So it became a huge topic of the COP. And it really competed, I think, with the adaptation bit that the presidency wanted. So we had these two main, I think, central themes throughout the COP that ended up playing out in the second week of adaptation finance versus mitigation and trying to make sure that we got both in the final package. And I think we did to some point. So I think that, yes, they succeeded, maybe not fully, but to a certain degree, to make the COP30 the COP of adaptation.
It did feel like, yes, at some points the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, right? I mean, the run-up to this COP, there had been a number of events that Ana Toni, the CEO of COP, had attended, and the COP president himself had attended, really kind of promoting adaptation. I was at a conference earlier this year, and you were there as well, with the Instituto Talanoa, talking about the importance of adaptation. Brazilian ministers were on board talking about this. And then, yes, President Lula comes out and says, fossil fuel roadmap, and pushes the deforestation agenda and the Tropical Forest Fund. It felt like there was a clash of priorities going on there. But it does seem like the square was circled at the end.
Yeah, and I think it also forced us to be creative, but also remind everyone that adaptation and mitigation are not in isolation. It's all within the spectrum of climate action, and forests particularly and nature protection are a huge part of both adaptation and mitigation. So there were definitely many opportunities to push both agendas. And in the end, we did get an outcome on both. So I think it was successful on elevating adaptation, particularly more than in the past.
So one of the major outcomes of this COP was agreement on a new adaptation finance target. In the overall cover decision that was agreed on Saturday, there was a call for a tripling of adaptation finance, and alongside that, an urging to developed countries to increase the trajectory of their finance. So can you talk a little bit about the language of that goal, what it actually means in practice, and how does it set the stage for further discussions on adaptation finance at next year's bond meetings and at COP31?
Developing countries had been asking for 2 years for something like this, because last year, as you know, we had the big negotiations around just an overall climate finance target, and developing countries were seeking that within that there would be a specific target for adaptation. And then that was not achieved last year. So this year it was, you know, we had certain finance elements coming up as well that provided an opportunity to kind of revive that push. And one of these was that the Glasgow Pact to double adaptation finance by 2025 was expiring. So without an adaptation finance target in the NCQG and the expiration of this target this year, if there was nothing agreed at COP30 for adaptation finance, there really wasn't going to be kind of a North Star for adaptation finance at all. And in the context of, you know, cuts and in budgets for development aid, cuts on climate finance, there was a really big risk for adaptation finance to kind of drop to the bottom of the priority list. So I think that the deal that we got really demonstrated the difficulties of the geopolitical space that we find ourselves, but also a lot of compromise from both sides. I mean, they came into the negotiation saying that for them, a target was a big red line, that they could not commit to something that they could not know for sure that they would be able to meet. You know, there's a lot of competing priorities with Ukraine, with, you know, just the geopolitical situation. But developing countries also said that this was a red line for them, that with the expiration of the Glasgow Pact, with national adaptation plans coming forward this year, there was a need to know that there would be finance coming through for implementation of adaptation on the ground. So what ended up happening was that there is a call to triple adaptation finance in the context of the NCQG, the goal that was negotiated last year. And before that call, there's kind of a recommitting of doubling adaptation finance by 2025. Then there comes the call to triple adaptation finance. And in the end, it says that developed countries must scale their trajectory of adaptation finance. So it's a bit kind of broken down in these three parts. And I think developing countries would have liked to have kind of like a more joint, coherent language where there was a baseline to that tripling by 2030 instead of 2035, which is what it ended up being. And they would have liked specific language saying that developed countries must be the ones that are providing this finance and in grant form. Instead, as I said, we got the tripling by 2035. There is no clear baseline. There is that mention of 2025. So we can kind of assume that because that mention is there on the doubling by 2025 and we are in 2025, it's somewhat implied that the deadline, the baseline is there, but it's not clear. And I'm sure that this will come up again. And then finally, there is that, you know, urging to developed countries to scale finance, but it's not, you know, it's not a decision. It's quite weak, I think, language-wise, but the message is clear that developed countries must lead in this target and must deliver around $120 billion in US dollars for adaptation finance by 2035, which it's also, you know, coherent with what they had agreed last year in the NCQG. They agreed that there should be a balance between mitigation and adaptation. So that's, you know, let's say 50% of 300 is 150. So in a way, they added layers and granularity to the NCQG by agreeing to this. It's not, you know, like it's a brand new goal with, you know, finance on top of those 300. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I actually think by incorporating this adaptation finance target within the NCQG, parties kind of got around the complaints of some developed nations, which was they don't want to reopen the finance agreement that was torturously agreed last year at Baku. So I think actually, yes, seeing this adaptation target as a fleshing out of the NCQG is helpful. I will say, yeah, looking at the language, you know, there's all this strange hierarchy of language in COP, right? And this tripling of adaptation finance comes under the kind of calls for language. But I was looking back at the COP21 agreement and the language there is just urges, right? So it's not requests, not decides, which are the strongest terms. So even though in COP26, there was this urges language to double adaptation finance, that still became kind of the clarion call for developed countries to raise their ambitions. And even though the latest data shows that for 2023, adaptation finance from developed countries to developing countries was only 26 billion, it's still seen in the context of that 40 billion target. So having something to kind of anchor expectations, anchor efforts on adaptation finance too, I think is really important, because this now Belém target, whatever you want to call it, is going to be reiterated in all sorts of forums, bilateral negotiations, conferences, etc., and hopefully shall create some momentum towards scaling up the adaptation finance.
That's how I see it. I think there were some chatter among civil society of like, did this lock us in some sort of bad deal? Maybe it would have been better to have no deal and to try something better next year. But we don't know. We don't know what the geopolitics are going to be like next year. It's unlikely they'll be significantly better. And because of the expiration of the Glasgow Pact this year, I really think that this was our best chance to lock in a new target. So I do think there's, you know, a lot of room for improvement, but that this is better than no deal.
And looking at the kind of satellite agreements around the adaptation finance agreement, there was a decision on establishing a two-year work program on climate finance. There was, of course, the publication of the Baku to Belém roadmap to $1.3 trillion in finance. Now, that's supposed to come from all sources, not just public sources, government sources. But there were a lot of papers and talking shops created to talk about climate finance some more. So looking at overall at the climate finance discussions at COP, how do you see them also helping to support the adaptation finance goal?
Yeah, I think that the roadmap is also not perfect. It received some critiques from developing countries saying, we feel like this is putting the burden on us. But they, you know, it does contain steps and, you know, pathways towards a scaling finance that can be used by many countries. Also contains lists, you know, of good practices, case studies. I think that the conversation around Article 9 that was set up by the decision, the copper text, also provides an opportunity to continue to look at these actions and what they can unlock. But I think that the final finance package is a lot stronger than developed countries, you know, we're envisioning to agree to next year, especially if the adaptation gap reports keep coming out and demonstrating that the gap is just getting bigger and bigger. The discussion around adaptation finance is definitely not over.
Let's turn now to the Global Goal on Adaptation, the GGA, and the agreement that was reached on adaptation indicators. The idea here was to create a common language for countries to use to measure adaptation progress. And in the run-up to COP30, we had this technical expert group that was formed under the last COP presidency. They came out with 100 potential indicators that countries could use, covering all the targets that are enumerated in the Global Goal on Adaptation. For those who don't know, the GGA is an objective within the Paris Agreement and has been seen and described by people like yourself, Anna, as like the equivalent, the adaptation equivalent of the 1.5 degree mitigation target. So it's a big deal to kind of try and get these indicators done because it allows for a measurable effort towards adaptation. Can you explain what the negotiations were like over the GGA? What was the outcome we got from those deliberations?
Yeah, of course. And the GGA was really the biggest piece of the negotiations this year. So it gathered a lot of attention. The negotiations started off a bit wonky because there was a new proposal by the African group of negotiators to set up a new work program. And I think that moved the negotiations on week one around the follow-up process to a decision this year, instead of really diving into the indicators, which was kind of the mandate, was to agree to the indicators at this COP. So as I said, on week one, suddenly negotiations really focused on what the follow-up was going to be like. There were countries, for example, in Grupo Sur, led by Uruguay, who really asked, hey, let's have informal informals, which are like huddles that countries have in the corner of the room, to be able to tackle the indicators quickly and effectively. But other groups wanted to stay in a more like plenary, you know, discussion setting, which really made everything go quite slowly. And, you know, by the end of week one, countries had had only a few hours to discuss the indicators. So then the presidency took over and developed a text that had a bit of everything. It had a new work program. It had new consultation by experts on the adaptation committee, on the LDC expert group, etc. And it had an annex with some suggested indicators for adoption. When we started paying attention to these annex, we realized that actually the indicators in it did not match the indicators that had been worked on for 2 years in the previous work program. And this raised a lot of flags. However, by week two, it was obvious there was going to be a cover text. One, because there were many pieces of COP30 that didn't have kind of a negotiated track to land. And two, because there had been new agenda items that were not assigned and there were consultations taking place. So a cover text kind of had emerged, this Muchidao decision. And most of the political attention, if not all, went to this text. And it really took the attention away from the GGA. And also the leverage was not there anymore. So what happened was, by the end of COP, countries were finalizing their agreement and cover text. There was a lot of lack of transparency, so we don't know exactly what the process was, but the plenary session was delayed multiple hours because countries realized what was going on the DGA and wanted to talk to the presidency about it. We don't know exactly what happened, but in the end, a plenary took place. And because of procedural issues, the presidency gaveled the GGA text without opening the floor for objections. In this process of gaveling through, actually, a couple countries raised their flags to object to the text, but it was too late by the time they were able to take the floor. This led, I think it was the EU, Canada, Panama, Uruguay, and Sierra Leone to be quite angry at the presidency and call out this lack of transparency, lack of process. And they said that outright they rejected this GGA text. It happened with something similar on the mitigation side as well, with Colombia rejecting the mitigation work program. And these points of order brought the plenary to a halt. After much legal discussion, they communicated that indeed, once something has been gaveled, it cannot be ungaveled. The only way forward legally would be to have a new decision. That was not going to happen, you know, in the afternoon of already, you know, an extra day of COP. So they've put a pin on it until Bonn next year in June. So it's very unclear how they plan to tackle this rejection of the text next year. What I anticipate is that these sets of indicators have been adopted, but there are so many methodology issues with these indicators. Their legitimacy is, you know, in the floor. I think they will have to reopen it at some point. I think the work program, the new work program that was set up to politically align the indicators, will have to do tremendous work to kind of put these indicators back in shape so that they can be used. Otherwise, I mean, it will really be a major failure because, as you say, this is a key part of the Paris Agreement. We've been waiting for 10 years for this moment, for these indicators to be part of the GGA so they can become operational, countries can track progress, they can guide efforts, and now they have these unusable indicators. We'll see how they decide to deal with this issue, but I think it will have to change the indicators one way or another.
It was always clear to me that despite the expert group putting a lot of work into creating these 100 potential indicators, it was a bureaucratic expert group and not a political body. So I was kind of pre-warned, again, by people like you to say, look, this is a political process is going to take over. We're not sure what's going to happen. The expert group has done the best they can with limited resources. But really, it is going to be a squalid compromise, like much that happens in COP. The scary thing is, though, as you mentioned, the wording of some of the indicators does not lend themselves to being measurable, does not lend themselves to being credible. And whether they can actually be deployed usefully by countries to measure adaptation is really up to debate. It does seem to me, though, again, like the Brazilian presidency kind of threw some sneaky maneuvering, and maybe by some incompetence and mistakes, right? They did get something approved and passed so that they could say, look, we have an agreement on the GGA. And yes, even though the can is kicked down to future discussions where these things will be fleshed out and tweaked and probably a lot of the indicators will either be thrown out or overhauled, they can still say, look, we did move the ball forward. And that's sometimes all you can hope for in a COP, right, is to move the ball forward. However, I do want to know what you think about how these indicators may or may not be used for other aspects of measuring climate progress, like the biennial transparency reports and the other kind of adaptation planning that is done by developing countries. Are they going to be useful in the current context, or do you think they'll be ignored?
That's a difficult question to answer. I don't think in their current form they will be useful. There's also aspects of the targets of the UAE framework for global climate resilience that they don't have indicators at all. I think the ones on poverty and livelihoods, for example. And then, you know, the health indicators seem to imply that adaptation action can cause disease. It's just, you know, it's challenging. There's also parts of the rest of the text that talk about how these indicators should not set up new methodology. There's also no clarity on what they've been calling custodian organizations. So like which organizations will kind of host these indicators and, you know, be in charge of the tracking or supporting countries in their tracking. So it's very, very unclear what the way forward is. So I think once the indicators go back to a more usable wording, we will be able to track them at some level. But all that working out of custodians and timelines, et cetera, still needs to be figured out. That's why it's a shame that we kind of lost week two of negotiations, because I do think that there was appetite for many countries to get all that figured out. But as I said, the political tension went to the COP decision, then it was a bit too late for the GGA.
Having something agreed, even in a odd, skewed, inappropriate form, perhaps, it could be useful because these things take on a life of their own, right? Like I'm already thinking myself about taking the indicators that were gaveled through and doing some analysis of national adaptation plans and seeing like what maps to what and actually how useful these indicators could be as measures of adaptation progress. And I think you'll see a lot of nonprofits and think tanks do the same and do some real critiques of these indicators. And hopefully by the time we get to the next discussions, we'll have a much clearer view about how useful or not they are and what needs to be done to make them more useful for developing countries. So again, something better than nothing. And I think it can spark a new, fresh round of debate and investigation into the utility of adaptation indicators. That's what I hope anyway. But I do feel for the expert group that saw their hard work kind of torpedoed. And again, as you mentioned in the negotiation, this did seem another occasion where the left hand and not the right hand was doing. The COP presidency could have undermined itself. This could have been the big flagship agreement. And it did seem that this was being held up as it was going to be the big flagship agreement by ministers and COP experts. And then with the fossil fuel roadmap and the deforestation roadmap kind of took the wind out of the sails.
Yeah. And if I may add, I mean, there were 3 years of negotiations on the targets and with experts and negotiators. And that culminated on the framework that set up the, you know, the expert group. And these experts, they volunteer their time and travel the world, you know, in their own, you know, means to work on these indicators for another 2 years. So it's been 10 years coming, and 5 of those have been like really intense work. So that's where the issue of legitimacy comes through. And we don't officially know how these new indicators came to be, but we have a sense of the views that are most represented. And I think that's also, it has eroded trust, I think, between parties.
Yes, there's a sense that things were agreed on without the consensus of everybody and in an underhand fashion or slightly underhand fashion, which caused consternation. Let's move on to some of the other adaptation initiatives that happened within COP and kind of around the outside of COP. So one perhaps overlooked positive was the conclusion of the National Adaptation Plan, the NAP assessment process, which is something that had been kicked down the road by the last COP presidency. Can you talk a little bit about the NAP assessment and also National Adaptation Plans, where we are in that process now?
Yeah, for sure. And as you say, National Adaptation Plans were 2 years behind. So it's great that it concluded. I think the process really brought to light just the lack of capacity that developing countries have in developing NAPs, the lack of certainty that they will be implementable, that they will receive the money and the technology and the capacity to make them into reality. The final outcome, I think, takes note of these struggles with concern in some cases, but it doesn't bring finance into the conversation, doesn't decide anything around finance. It does request a few key things. It requests the Adaptation Committee and the Least Developed Countries Expert Group to create a report on these gaps and needs. It's also asked for new reports on what are different approaches to integrating adaptation in national plans and policy implementation. And it decides that the next assessment will take place in 2028. So hopefully with this new reports that come out, countries have a better sense and more certainty around what do they have to look like, and they're worth doing because we will be able to implement them because the money will be there. But yeah, I mean, NAPs were due this year, and I think we're not even at 50% of countries that have submitted NAPs. I mean, even the European Union hasn't submitted a NAP yet. They just had their risk assessment published last year. So it really is a struggle to get countries to care about this topic and to prepare ahead.
Yes, I think depending on which text you're reading, there are 71 or 72 developing country parties that submitted their NAPs. And actually, that was quite a big boost from where we were last year. So it does feel like a recognition that there was going to be hopefully an agreement on the NAP assessment, maybe encouraged some countries to speed up their work. And developed countries, it's less of a concern, I suppose. But yes, there has been a lot of delay on that front. We did see kind of around COP a lot of focus on investment in adaptation in the context of NAPs, right? And we spoke about this last week about the FINI FINI initiative set up by the Atlantic Council and Natural Resources Defense Council. This is going to be some sort of networking hub to kind of help turn national adaptation plans into investment pipelines. We also saw the COP presidency put together a NAP implementation alliance, also focused on turning NAPs from just documents that are loaded up to the UNFCCC into actually useful blueprints for investment. So what do you make of those developments? Is this a part of a drive to kind of make national adaptation plans much more integrated in countries' infrastructure planning and public investment strategies?
Yeah, I think these two initiatives are quite interesting. And with everything on the action agenda, it's always exciting to see the announcement. But let's see, right? Like, will they actually achieve anything? And will there be kind of continuancy? We saw, for example, last year in the G7, the Adaptation Accelerator Hub launched by Italy, and then it was never heard of ever again. So I'm hoping that's not the case with these two initiatives. I do think they get it right in terms of what the needs are. Two platforms are multi-stakeholder, that's bringing the private sector, they're bringing local actors, and they're really trying to make these NAPs a usable document, both for policymakers, but also for investment. I think it's the right move. I mean, definitely is what needs to happen. I am concerned about whether they will be backed up with both political attention and finance. Let's see. I think that there is definitely the appetite from developing countries to improve their NAPs and to publish NAPs. They just have to know that they will be, you know, it'll be worth the effort.
Yeah, you see, so I'm of the mindset, which is what would have a greater effect on driving adaptation finance, particularly private finance adaptation, would be for a couple of organizations that are household names, so like a Swiss Re or a Allianz Insurance or another large asset manager, to just say, hey, look, we're putting $10 million into adaptation in these LDCs. These are the exact projects we're putting our money into. This is why we think they're good investments, and provide some real solid case studies that can break through some of the kind of confusing noise about, oh, networks and talking shots and that stuff. I still feel we need some concrete deals that are made that can somewhat wake the market up. And we have seen that this year. I mean, earlier this year, we did see the Insurance Development Forum finally launch a climate resilient infrastructure fund, which does have backing from Zurich and Allianz, but we still don't know exactly where that money's going to go. The fund's been raised, but where's that money going to go to? And are they going to make a big song and dance about where that money's going to? You do have other organizations like the Zurich Climate Resilience Alliance, which is fronted by the Foundation for Zurich Insurance, also doing good work investing in adaptation. But I still feel like we need to kind of elevate real case studies rather than having discussions about roadmaps all the time and implementation.
Yeah, the roadmap for the roadmaps. I'm a big champion of the adaptation funds, and that's why I like them so much. And I always try to invite them to things because they do have that expertise and those case studies. I remember hearing about, for example, their work in Jamaica and how the airport was getting flooded every hurricane season. And the road that led to the airport was unusable at those times where it was most needed because aid was coming in, etc. And it was an adaptation fund project with the little budget that they have that fixed that problem. I mean, you know, when an entire country was now able to use their airport during an event like this. So I think, as you say, it's super important to always bring it back to the real world. What does it mean to make an app investable? And what does it mean to invest in an app? That means saving lives, supply chains, livelihoods. It really is strategic to have an app.
And now you mentioned the Adaptation Fund there, and I was just going over the announcements at COP on the Adaptation Fund. So this is the UN convened fund specifically for investing in adaptation products in the developing world. They had a fundraising target of this year of $300 million US, and they managed $133 million US. So not so great. Also, last year, they only raised about half of what they wanted to. And there was also some hopes this year that there would be agreement on somewhat retooling the Adaptation Fund to kind of make it a little bit more effective and to help channel more finance towards it. Can you give us a quick update on the Adaptation Fund?
Yeah, I think it was delayed. The whole conversation about the governance of the fund and whether it would stand under the Convention, the Paris Agreement, just the Paris Agreement, this is always an issue at COG. But the reality is that year after year now, I think for 3 years in a row, the Adaptation Fund hasn't been able to fundraise its target of $300 million. And I know this year they had a really tough conversation of like, should we lower this target? And it's a shame because it is a dedicated fund for adaptation. It does some great work. Its board is mostly made of developing countries. So it really, you know, it has some very innovative solutions and direct access that we know is transforming adaptation at the local community level. So when I was discussing a lot with developed countries this year about the broader adaptation finance target, I often said to them, listen, I appreciate that you don't want to commit to something that you can't do, and committing to $120 billion in this economy is tough. But you know what low-hanging fruit there is you know, really filling the adaptation fund. This is millions, not billions. It's, you know, it can really help with that trust building we were talking about. It can demonstrate that you're serious about increasing adaptation fund. Make that your first step. If you can't commit to a larger target, at least do that. So it was quite disappointing to know that they missed their target again. At the end of the day, I think it just goes to show that developed countries want to keep their money under control, and they're not ready to give to a fund that's mostly developing countries. So I'll continue to champion the work of the adaptation, and I hope they don't give up.
Yes, I was going over the figures from the last few years, and last time the Adaptation Fund did exceed its fundraising target was the only year in recent history that the US, the European Commission, and the UK donated substantial amounts. If you look like this year, you still see some developed world countries, maybe Germany actually, and Switzerland put a lot of money in. Some of the Nordic countries do, but it's quite notable that some of the biggest G7 countries have stayed away from the Adaptation Fund for the last few years, which again seems strange to me because, yes, I know all these countries are curtailing overseas development assistance, but the UK could put a couple of million in. And
yeah, exactly. I'm sure there's something that can be done with that 1 million. So yeah, every bit counts. And like I said, it's millions, not billions. You know, we should be able to get there. And another thing that I wish we were talking about in the adaptation finance space is the solidarity levies. We saw the task force on solidarity levies launched a premium flyers coalition at Finance for Development earlier this year. They signed up to 9 countries at COP30, including Spain, France, Kenya, Benin, And basically what they're going to do is that they're going to put levies on all the premium flights. So that is business, first class, private jets. I was reading it can be up to $34 billion that could be raised if these levies were implemented worldwide. It can make a huge difference, and that's just premium flights. I would like to work with developed countries next year in getting them to sign on to initiatives like this that unlock grant finance for adaptation without getting into geopolitical games. We'll see. There's a lot of potential.
But solidarity levies, I think, are a good idea. Trying to make them universal is the hardest thing, but actually politically asking the wealthiest to pay just a tiny little bit more on their international flights, I think, is an easier sell than broad-based income taxes on the population at large.
Yeah, exactly. And they've done studies on this that people are actually quite supportive of things like this, you know, because I get it. I get the developed countries are saying, listen, we're struggling at home. We don't have the internal kind of support to increase, you know, in the billions adaptation finance for other countries. But something like this, I think, could really fly domestically and make a difference. So we'll see.
I think it's notable that even Bill Gates, every time he talks about private air travel, he talks about, oh, and I offset everything with carbon credits. So even he's aware that, yes, there is a direct link between premium air travel and climate change. Okay, so this was billed as the adaptation COP, as the implementation COP. We had a kind of messy end to the summit, but there have been mixed reports. I've been going over the commentary. Some folks saying that this shows that multilateralism is still alive in COP, and even though it's very hard and difficult and you never get everything you want, this COP showed that multilateral climate action is still worth fighting for and still can achieve things. What do you think? Do you think this COP demonstrated the value of multilateralism? And what grade would you give the Brazilian presidency overall for how it handled the summit?
Yeah, I think that this COP demonstrated just how tough the situation is for multilateralism, but that, you know, at the end, it comes through, even with its challenges. I would give the presidency 5 or 6 out of 10 as in a grade, you know, C plus maybe. But listen, I think in the negotiated track is where they really struggled. I think that they tried to make everyone happy by including, you know, pretty much everything that, you know, everyone wanted, but just in a very weak way so that it was okay with everyone. And that led to just, as we were talking, like just very watered down language across the board. Where they did, I think, much better was in the action agenda. And that's where I think this presidency really gets a passing grade. They did have some really innovative initiatives around, you know, forests, the TFFF launch, and these initiatives on NAPs, initiatives on climate and health. And I think we're going to start to see this more and more, because COPs need to move towards implementation, as we've heard over and over. The negotiated track in itself, it doesn't lend itself to implementation. Right? It lends itself to pledging. But the action agenda is where the actual implementation is taking place. So we will see that the action agenda is where the presidencies can really deliver on this implementation and where they're putting a lot of their diplomatic weight and effort. So we'll see, as I said, that's great. But there is an issue of transparency in the action agenda and continuity. So hopefully...
And legal force, right? They're not as binding because they're not part of the Paris Agreement.
Exactly. They don't have that accountability. So I think as COP transforms, now that the kind of the rule book of the Paris Agreement has been laid out, I hope there will be some sort of continuity of precedencies or some, you know, some way to embed some accountability on these. And I do think with the Brazilians, you know, they are very active in climate diplomacy and diplomacy overall. I think that they will take forward these initiatives, but not every presidency is like that or has that credibility. I think there's appetite for not that many new initiatives, but to see the initiatives really deliver. I think we'll move towards implementation, but we will need demonstration as well at the same time to ensure that the momentum keeps going forward.
Yes, doing a few things very well rather than trying to do a lot of things poorly might be the way we actually probably move the needle on climate action, on mitigation and adaptation, right? So on the mitigation side, making sure that NDCs, nationally determined contributions, these decarbonization plans are very credible, are actually implementable. That's so important on the mitigation side. On the adaptation side, I think it is getting national adaptation plans to be useful documents that can guide decision-making by countries and also guide finance from the international community towards adaptation, I think is so important. And yes, the indicators is part of that as well. But I also think we don't need to worry too much about getting every indicator perfect. We need to have a good measurement system that's credible and people can agree on. And there can be some ambiguity in the language, but I feel like if we've got some core principles on which to rest adaptation progress, I think that's all for the good. Okay, Anna, thank you so much for giving us this wrap-up of COP and the adaptation agenda. Really appreciate you spending the time, because I know you've been busy talking to lots of folks, journalists like myself, but also negotiating teams, other think tanks. I'm sure many other people have been WhatsApping you and calling you over the last few days to kind of get your take and to understand what's going on. So I really appreciate you taking the time out to talk to us. And yes, I'll be in touch again soon, no doubt, to go over what happens with this COP agenda at Bonn next year and in the run-up to the next COP, which is going to be taking place in Turkey, but yes, under an Australian presidency. That's a whole other discussion.
Yeah, that's for another day. But thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. I'll see you in Bonn.
Climate Proofers is a Climate Proof Media production. It is produced and presented by me, Louis Woodall. Subscribe to the Climate Proof newsletter by going to climateproof.news/subscribe. And to learn more about the publication, feel free to reach out directly using our LinkedIn page. Goodbye for now.